Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Abarca with co-hosts, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson, and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webnode.com. Today we will be doing part three of a series of episodes that we have been doing with Andy about his personal organizing union work as school begins to, quote, reopen, unquote, alongside online distance learning. And just what are the implications of the role for profit-driven data of tech in education? So we'll be following up on those conversations that we've been having ongoingly with Andy. Andy, I'm distracted, and I want to keep this in the episode. And the reason why I'm distracted is because I'm hearing honking in the background, which are protesters. And I live in like the suburbia part of San Francisco, which is the outer. I don't know if I want to say that where I live, but I live in the outskirts of SF, still within SF, and I can hear the honking going, and protesters are out and about. So oh, it's wow. Cool. So yeah. Anyhow. That's just what's my world out here as my window is open. Andy, in this context of what is going on in your own organizing work, you are going, why don't you tell us what you had communicated with us over the phone and what you wanted to do for this episode?
Yeah. So I don't know where this episode is going to totally go, but what I was really hoping to do, and Eduardo, you and I have been talking about how increasingly what's left is played more of a role of actually helping me organize and helping me think about what am I doing politically in my education work and my work as a socialist, really. And Kenny's gotten on board on that, and it's led to opportunities to meet people from Albuquerque and like people like Allison and a whole host of other people. Increasingly, it's actually played a role of getting me to network with people who I wouldn't have otherwise networked with and who I think are going to help me figure out politically what the hell's going on and what we should be doing, at least what I think we should be doing. And for this episode, I wrote recently. Strike Ready SF put out a statement about the position it took in relationship to the opening of schools, and I've been thinking a lot about this. I've been talking with Brian, with Jack Gerson, other revolutionaries, and
on this show before.
Yeah, Brian Belknap. And I'm probably, I would say I describe my position as somewhat like, I'm kind of alone on the position I have around what we should be doing around the opening of schools. And it's sort of led me to wanting to talk through what I think should be going on and what the response is from others and what do I see as what the left is saying, why I'm not particularly happy with that, why I don't think it's a good, it leads us in the right direction. I was hoping to use this episode to talk that through a little bit and take questions from both of you, devil's advocate questions or even questions you have. And I think I even asked Jack and Brian to throw us some questions as well that y'all might throw in the mix as well.
Can you maybe give us some context as to what's happening, what is being proposed, and then what your position is?
Yeah. So in about 2 or 3 weeks ago, Strike Ready SF has really struggled of late. And the union movement has struggled of late to find our footing, to figure out what we're doing. And our meetings have gotten smaller. And, you know, there have just been more debates about which way to go on things. And it sort of culminated, at least for me, in this, which Strike Ready SF had a meeting. I don't think I was at it, but they reported that essentially they reported a position of support of Black Lives Matter, which I'm fine with that, you know, the George Floyd protests and things like that. But they specifically had stuff around the opening of schools. And they reported that Strike Ready SF is against the austerity that's coming. And I again agree with that. But they really, the emphasis on opening schools is about health safety, is about the possibility, being open to the possibility of distance learning. I don't think that's just not a good position to me. Like, I think that openness to distance learning, the openness to contact tracing, that's not the position Strike Ready SF has taken, but it's often like that. The American Federation of Teachers, the union position is really like, it's very health focused, it's very coronavirus focused. And I think that's the wrong focus. I think our focus actually needs to be, and very much laser focused on our battle against the capitalists. And if we try to say we're going to fight the coronavirus by fighting the cap, we're going to fight the capitalists by fighting coronavirus, we're going to fall into their trap, because I think the coronavirus is being used as an attack on workers. The social distancing, the contact tracing, the distance learning, everyone being quarantined, to me, by and large, represents part of an attack on the working class. And we can't adopt that language to fight the capitalists. We have to fight them really on our terms. We can't fight them. I think if we fight them around the coronavirus and make health the over-abiding concern for August, then we will fall right into their trap of accepting distance learning, of accepting some level of their narrative about what's going on, because I think the coronavirus is being used for other purposes. That is, for purposes, well, not for other purposes. The by and large, I see that the coronavirus is part of the talk of health concerns about coronavirus and keeping people separated and controlling people and collecting everyone's data is all part of a plan of U.S. competing with China that will lead to U.S. war with China. But the reality is a U.S. war with China can only happen when the U.S. ruling class makes war on the working class. And so I don't think we can take up that war by taking up their excuse for fighting us. We have to put it on our terms. And so the thing I put out basically to Strike Ready SF was, I'm all for fighting this cuts, absolutely. But I don't think we should accept any distance learning. We should reject it well, 100%. Any distance learning plan, any hybrid plan, we should not accept that. Secondly, we should accept no contact tracing strategy plan for us or for our students. And third, if we do go on strike, the strike is not to keep ourselves healthy, because we can't. The strike is not even for fully funded schools. The strike is to strike so we can spread the strike. The goal of the strike is to spread the strike, to extend the uprising that really has taken place with regards to George Floyd around this. But again, I was saying this before this happened around George Floyd, so I don't want to act like this is related, but essentially what I'm saying is our reason for striking is to spread the strike and to create the possibility of workers' control. And I don't see any other way of doing that other than starting a strike whose aim is to spread a strike and extend it throughout San Francisco, throughout Oakland, throughout California, throughout the country, and ultimately build such a movement that would be an international strike wave that to take down our respective governments and to fight their attempt to use the coronavirus to control us in various ways. Does that seem like a pretty good summary of what?
Yeah. I mean, I would like to go piece by piece.
Okay.
I wrote down your three. You said ultimately your intention is to reject online distance learning, reject contact tracing, and spread the strike.
Yeah,
I mean,
I said, here's how I summarized it in the letter to Strike Ready SF. I said, no distance learning, no contact tracing, no cuts, and yes to waging a fight against all these things by starting a strike whose aim is to spread the strike and make workers' revolution a possibility.
Yeah.
If we maybe take on the first part, what is the option to distance learning? You know, and is there any validity to some concerns about health? Because I could see why some people would have concerns that, you know, you might be jeopardizing kids' health or your own health. So what do you have to say to that?
I mean, I think
Kenny's question?
Say again?
Is it all right if I add?
Yeah.
Just it's
yeah.
Kenny's question is, I think, very crucial in the, because it's tricky. It's always tricky talking about a very sensitive issue as if this isn't actually happening. You know, people do have hoax theories and stuff, conspiracies that this isn't happening. And this might be fuel for some of that conspiracy thought and talk about how this is just a hoax. And so Kenny's question is very important because it's very important because parents, families, teachers, their people's concerns are really at the forefront. And I understand you think it's a political trap. COVID-19 could be used as a political trap. I get that. And so how are you going to... what Kenny said. What Kenny's question is very crucial. I mean, I'll leave it to just the way Kenny's question was. Yeah.
I mean, first off, the reasons that I think these things are going on, the distance learning plans, the hybrid models, the reason the state is doing them has nothing to do with our safety. It has everything to do with privatizing the schools, to moving to a system that is much more with regards to data collection of students, collection of us. The same with the contact tracing. So all those things, that is not the reason the same state that killed George Floyd, that is killing black people, that is, you know, that's created this police state, essentially. That's not why these are in place. They're being put in place to control us. That's the first thing. The second thing I would say is in saying I reject distance learning, I reject the fact that we're going to be able to keep ourselves safe in any sort of thing as we are. There's going to be risks going out to George Floyd protests. There's going to be risks to strike. There's going to be this notion of safety doesn't exist under capitalism. And yes, it doesn't really exist under any situation of virus. I will say, though, that let's remember, at first they were talking about 4% death rate for the thing. Then it went to 2%. Then it went for 1%. And now it's 0.3%. You know, and the CDC, even I probably could show you something, but the CDC has put out even numbers that really show that the number of deaths that have taken place is not this year, is not that far from what it had been in other cycles in 2017, in 2015. It's not a huge number here in the United States that is much bigger. And people go, oh, it's social distancing and stuff like that. I don't think the social distancing has accomplished that. That's my take on it when I look at places like Sweden and stuff like that, where they used a less of a social distance to do it. I think what we have here is a virus, and not a reason to give in to a surveillance state and a security state kind of panic. So those are the things that I say, and I would just say that the biggest threat that I think is facing us is not death from a virus. We can talk about the fact that it hasn't hurt kids nearly as much as it has elderly, and that the people who've obviously children have to make choices about that if they have elderly at home and things like that. But in all honesty, I think the idea is not, for me, the idea is not to go back to schools as normal. All right. I actually think we can't even go back to the normal public school because those normal public schools weren't working. We have to fight for a completely different system. And that fight is going to require us to get together in large groups. And that fight is necessary now. So I reject the notion that there's safety to be found in here if we are going to do what needs to be done. The things we need to do to make the world safe for everyone requires us engaging in class struggle and in class warfare. And that means engaging the capitalist class directly in battle, ultimately, of various sorts. And it also means us getting together, and we're going to not be 6 feet separated. I mean, there's ways to do that. That notion of keeping ourselves healthy is a myth. It was a myth before the virus, and it's a myth in the existence of the virus. And I think there's been a lot. I do believe the capitalist class has done a lot to overestimate, like all the things we said in those episodes early on about this is really looking like a flu. I think this is still the case. I stand by what this largely has been a type of flu, a new flu, and they've used it to basically try to create wholesale changes in our working conditions, and under the situation under which we live. It's not a rule. It's not a new ruling class. The ruling class has always been oppressive, has always been interested in surveillance, but now they're going to escalate that, and we can't adopt that. We have to fight that, and that fight needs to happen now. And there's the only safe way to do that is to do it where we unite across national barriers, unite as workers across class. I mean, across racial lines, across gender lines. And we make that fight like huge. That is the safest way for this for us to go forward in the coming August. And there is no safe way for schools to reopen by keeping 6 feet of distance, by letting our data be collected. That's not safe at all. Not only is it not virally safe, it's a myth. It's not going to happen. And if it does happen, it will destroy our schools. But there's no safety in that, because the real thing that's taking place is the U.S. driving towards competition with China and using this as an excuse to, you know, kind of crush us under its boot in order to do that competition by collecting data on us, by surveilling us, by, you know, essentially feeding what I think is a large AI monster that they want to build so they can compete with China and compete with Europe on it. So I guess that's what I would say about that.
What would you say to, you know, the success of, you know, this approach worldwide in other nations taking, following the steps of Europe and China? Why, so they have a similar goal, those ruling classes, and it's just an opportunity for them to...
I think, from my vantage point, the best way... Well, let me put it this way. This is from the National Security Strategy document in 2017. And here's a summary of it. The strategy states that the primary challenge facing the Defense Department, this is for the United States, and the Joint Forces is the erosion of U.S. military advantage vis-a-vis China and Russia, which, if unaddressed, could ultimately undermine our ability to deter aggression and coercion and imperil the free and open order that we seek to underwrite with our alliance constellation. And then it goes on to say this: the contest over information accelerates these political, economic, and military competitions. Data, like energy, will shape U.S. economic prosperity and our future strategic position in the world. The ability to harness the power of data is fundamental to the continuing growth of America's economy, prevailing against hostile ideologies, and building and deploying the most effective military in the world. And I would say that this is not, that this authoritarian surveillance data collection engine, I actually don't even think, well, the U.S. has certainly been engaged in it, but right now China is leading it. The Chinese ruling class is leading the charge on surveilling its own people, on collecting data on its own people, and this is actually what the United States is worried about. And so the United States is trying to play catch-up. And if the United States is trying to play catch-up, then Europe has to play catch-up. This is how capitalism works. It's the reason why the American model of capitalism has increasingly been being introduced in Europe over the last 10 to 20 years, is that the European capitalists can't just keep the social contract alive that they have with workers. They have to shred that thing because they're competing with the U.S. capitalist class, which has already shredded that thing here decades ago. So that's how capitalism works. Capitalist class has to compete with each other on how they essentially control and... how they control their own working classes in their respective countries, and China's leading the charge. If you want the best way to understand what the U.S. is doing, is read what Forbes, Atlantic, the Wall Street Journal is saying about China, because everything they're saying about what China is doing and all their concerns about authoritarianism, about surveillance state, all those things are being introduced here. They're just behind on them. The contact tracing that they're doing here is far behind the contact tracing levels that exist in China. Where they've are, and now Google and Apple are trying to catch up now by building like these new APIs where they build in the possibility of contact tracing in what do they call it? It was exposure notification, by building an exposure notification API into the phone. And they say oh no, it's opt in, but if it becomes something where I go back to school and they say, oh, we're doing contact tracing, then they're going to insist that I have that on my phone. And they're going to say, you can't work in a school unless you have this thing, this exposure, this contact tracing thing operational. So it might be optional with regards to Google and Apple, but it's not going to be optional for workers when they're interested in basically, again, using this as a system of control.
So Andy, you don't really think the social distancing and the confinement that was implemented in Europe was effective?
I don't think it was necessarily, no. I don't think it was like, let me put it this way. I think it was effective in getting people to accept a level of control of their government over them that they wouldn't have accepted. And that's what it mostly accomplished.
But specifically about COVID-19, I understand you're saying that it was effective in civil obedience.
Yeah. I mean, it might have lowered the levels in some areas. I don't think it kept, like, but remember, you got to remember the British Imperial, the Niels Ferguson from the Imperial report was estimating 2.2 million dead in the United States. The reason we don't have 2.2 million dead is, I don't think, about social distancing. The difference between what they claim is the 100,000 that are dead, that have been killed due to it. Maybe it would have been 130, you know, but look what has happened as a result of that. Like, was it worth it? Like, was it worth it to basically, you know, smash small business, create a whole stimulus package that no one was in a position to resist because we were all separated, create a huge wealth upward in the context of an economic crisis that was largely, I think, produced by this, but in many ways, I think opportunistically by the U.S. and Chinese government to see who can win out in this competition. And so I would say maybe it made some difference, but when you compare it to all the damage that was done to people, I think the body count's going to be way higher as a result of the smashed economy, of the poverty that's been built in, what's happening with people in terms of suicides, stuff like this, and what's happened with people who couldn't even go to the hospital. But that's not really the issue for me. The issue is not like what numbers get you a bigger body count. The fact is that the only safety we have, the only true safety we have is the act of coming together and making a revolution. There is no other safety other than that. Everything else is a myth of safety. And so these steps that have been taken to get people to stay separated and to get people to accept the rationale of the state have been intensely damaging to the only thing that provides us the one safety we have, which is the ability to get together with other workers and fight in class struggle. That's the only safety we have for ourselves.
Some would argue, though, that, I mean, this entire confinement and the restrictions that have been implemented actually have hurt the economy more than have helped it. And so some have argued that, I mean, the argument could be that that isn't necessarily true, that it isn't about creating civil obedience and trying to, it has actually hurt the economy.
It's really hurt workers. Badly. It's hurt workers. It's hurt small business. It's helped Jeffrey Bezos. It's helped the capitalists. Actually, it's helped them immensely. They were able to essentially, I would look at this as like the conditions under which they did a kind of a controlled demolition of their economy, which was tanking anyway, and they've been able to blame the whole thing on the coronavirus when this is the normal life cycle. This is normal. This is literally what happened because of the collapse we just had was largely a result of the collapse of 2008 and the fact that they created all this fictitious capital in the first place. They knew this moment was coming, and now they get to blame it on a coronavirus. But the coronavirus isn't responsible for it. And so instead, now they get to take a second stimulus package where $4.5 trillion goes to the wealthiest capitalists in this country, and no one can do anything because we're all sheltering in place. And everyone's fucking freaking out about a coronavirus when what's really happening is we are getting robbed again under conditions where instead of blaming the capitalists and capitalism for the economy tanking, we blame a coronavirus. And we ourselves are being separated by that coronavirus, being told we're keeping you safe by the very looters and robbers who basically got away with $4.5 trillion. And that's just a small piece of how much they got away with. Yes, this is this was done. This was a giant gift to the U.S. capitalist class, to the Chinese capitalist class, which itself was facing a struggling Hong Kong, which has dealt with its own class struggle in its own country, and they've created a gigantic surveillance apparatus for any resistance that occurs within China. So the Chinese ruling class and the U.S. ruling class are sitting pretty relative to everyone else.
Say something. I wanted to say something to what you just said.
I mean, I don't know how much. I'm still grappling with this notion that the ruling class of this nation and many nations have done that have made up some huge lies that in years after, you know, we look back and we're like, wow, that was a fucking amazing lie. No doubt that they've taken this opportunity to restructure society, and that what you mentioned, Lipson, this controlled demolition, because the economy was already going down. There were a lot of indicators before this, including January, where the Federal Reserve was pumping money to keep this thing afloat. Donald Trump was, you know, trying to pressure. There were some games going on. Point being is that the restructuring of the economy wasn't going to happen anyway because of the looming recession. In every recession, workers end up doing more work. And then they end up squeezing the workers. That's what's happening, at least locally. That's what I noticed.
Yeah.
The other thing that is very curious is that around the world, we weren't leading up to the coronavirus. We kept talking about France, bringing up Colombia, Chile, a lot of Latin America. There was a lot of unrest with a lot of governments were losing legitimacy, or at least it's starting to be challenged. And this comes as a very convenient moment for these governments to reassert the state as a savior, as a, you know, the state coming in to save people, and them being the decision makers as to what's healthy and what is not, and basically taking that the choice from us, and as if we. We don't understand certain things.
Right.
Because even the U.S., the CDC, and I have a couple of friends that are in the healthcare industry, and they don't even know what to believe anymore. The CDC themselves didn't advise masks until like the third week. You know, so if this thing is so dangerous, wouldn't you advise to have a covering of some sort? They didn't do that until later. You know, and so I don't know to what degree it was, you know, planned or whatever. The fact is that they have taken this and run with it, and now we are, my family and I, we talk about how 3 months ago, we were scared of each other. We were eating 9 feet apart in the house. We weren't touching each other. We weren't hugging each other. And now my mom has gone to work. I've been at work. We are wearing a face covering, but we're not as messy. I've been to protests, and where most people are wearing masks, maybe that's a factor, but for the most part, you know, if anything, this. If there is some sort of spike, it's happened because the economy reopened or whatever. But of course, they're going to use this manipulation, at least this administration, to say that play capitalist games in the ruling class in this country. But the fact is that they are imposing a lot of new things that are very dangerous. And I agree with Lipson, just the thought. But it is very suspicious. And I don't think I am the only one with that suspicion, not socialists. Yeah. And a lot of people know, and they're starting to question what the hell is actually happening.
Right. I mean, look, the blue states on either end, the Newsoms and the Cuomos, who've been clamping down on their population big time. They're the first ones to be promoting Black Lives Matter in these demonstrations, right? They're the first ones who get out like, oh, this is so great. This is too important to not demonstrate. It's clear to me that these people are. And it's clear also that the Black Lives Matter demonstrations they see opportunistically as an opportunity to take down Trump. So they have been like, I do believe that the political forces are trying to like fight each other over opening economies, closing economies to see what kind of things are going to happen around the election in November. And that's the only way to make sense out of what Newsom and Cuomo and Trump are saying is one, to first understand that the U.S. is at war with the rest of the globe, and they're going to have to be at war with us in order to win that war. And two, that the immediate political fight is over the elections, and they're going to do anything and say anything to make those elections work for them. And in fact, we're now going to hear about a second wave of infection that is going to try to start to move people back off the streets now, because more people are getting killed. That guy got killed in Atlanta. But at this point, the Democrats have gotten everything they want out of this movement. They've got it now to, they can say defund the police, they can say elect Joe Biden, and they can take this to, that's what they're going to try to do, take it to November, but let's move it off the streets, because there's a second wave of infection coming around, so now we got to be careful again. So no, I think it's all, honestly, I think all that shit is nonsense and is made up. We can't know the truth because these people are liars. Is there a virus? Yes. But how do we know, we can't know the truth about it? And the one thing I can say is, even if you look at the CDC numbers, you see a rising and falling and rising and falling, and the numbers this year aren't that much bigger than 2017. And they're telling us that we got to completely restructure society on the basis of this. No. The reason they're restructuring society isn't about the virus. It's about the competition between the capitalists and the fact that that competition requires they have to extract massive amounts of surplus value out of their respective working classes. And the only way they can do that is for them to accept all levels of obedience, as well as the fact they've got to collect data on us because they're competing. Part of the competition is about AI and is about the future of the fourth revolution, which is the internet and data.
I mean, what I'm hearing is also that lots and lots of people all over the world think being confined is a rich people's problem as well. What I'm trying to say is most people think that there's a bigger issue than coronavirus, and it is discrimination or murder against black people. It is survival. There's bigger issues than this video, so they don't think about heeding to protocols as the government wants them to heed, because the government is beating down people. I mean, they just killed someone, I think, in India for not staying at home, and in South Africa as well. And the police has been very brutal under the name of coronavirus, and people think, this isn't what I'm going to die from. I'm going to die from something larger than coronavirus. I'm going to die from hunger. I'm going to die from being marginalized. I'm going to die from whatever systemic pressures there are. But in the West, the rhetoric is very strong about this is what we need to do to survive.
I mean, I actually don't agree that I think people have questions about it, and people were so pissed that they were willing to go out there. And some people didn't buy some of the narrative. But by and large, people are more trusting of the state and more trusting of the mainstream media now as a result of this than they were even a year ago. So I actually think the state has resurrected itself and done a lot to strengthen itself at a time when it's overseen a brutal separation of wealth from workers and directing it to the top. Not just in terms of the profits of the capitalists that they've received, but actually the banks being mobilized to give them resources. So I actually think that this has been effective, by and large, in getting people to say that, you know, I expect my state to keep me safe, you know. And so I'm going to say, look, we need contact tracing. I'm going to say that we need to keep ourselves distant when we open the schools. I'm going to say we need to, elect Joe Biden to oversee the police that are going to help us. You know, we need to make the police people who will be responsive to us. You can't, because the police are there to oversee your miseration. So I actually don't think people have seen through this. Unfortunately, I think by and large, and even the left, I believe, has by and large fallen for the notion that this, for the health, this is a health crisis we're facing, not a capitalist crisis. And I don't mean a capitalist crisis around health. I mean the capitalists using a health issue to extract massive concessions and massive changes in the way we live. and about to accept like wholesale changes in the way we're educated and impose those using it. And I say that because our unions are saying we need contact tracing. My Strike Ready SF, which put out something which said we need to stop, we have to not do distance learning, is saying, well, let's accept some distance learning. That's awful. That's actually falling direct. It's not just putting our students directly in that trap. It's putting us into the trap of automating our job, of making schools data collection centers. Ultimately, it will make schools so unworkable that no one's going to want to go to these schools. That there's going to be leftovers who want to go to these schools in terms of the kinds of – they're talking about, look, if we're going to keep you separated, gyms are going to have to be converted into classes, auditoriums converted into classes, and we're going to keep you all 6 feet away from each other, wear masks. It's like this kind of weird dystopian – like it's almost a funeral dirge. That's what they want schools to be like, or all separated from each other. How are you supposed to do a science lab with a partner and have 6 feet of separation? You can't. So what they're saying is that's all done. I think that's absurd. Like, I honestly believe that's absurd. We've always accepted the fact that there are viruses, that there are sicknesses. They come into the school. Teachers themselves are more subject to them. On the basis of these numbers, which to me are very small in terms of what we've seen from yearly pneumonia deaths, yearly respiratory deaths, it's not a huge increase compared to what has gone on yearly. And even CDC says that we're going to use that to justify a wholesale changing of all this. No, it doesn't make any sense. It only makes sense if you know that this is just a ploy ultimately to basically, you know, make our lives worse so that they can, so capitalists can compete.
And then it seems like, for example, I never stopped working this whole time. My restaurant never closed. So I noticed, you know, the first wave of shelter in place when people were fearing each other. And it's funny because the hypocrisy on the left of talking about states like Georgia, people marching to reopen their states. And then people here are socializing and like basically doing the same things. And it's fine, you know, I'm okay with that. Just is that be hypocrites because we're doing this. They're just being more direct to, you know, to their government and saying, like, listen, we want to reopen this shit. You know, but here we're being hypocrites pointing fingers that we know better because we follow our states. You know, and it goes on, it's another piece of evidence that the left is more willing to take what the state gives us at face value. And that if you challenge it, then you're a conspiracy theorist. If you challenge it, you must be from the right wing in ignorance. But the funny thing is that in the last few years, most of the actual challenges to the states have come from the right wing. You know, Alison McDowell, she mentioned how conservative moms are the ones fighting data mining. We also know that teacher strikes started from red states, not from Democratic or liberal states.
That's right.
You know, and so... It again shows the precariousness of the left and how we really don't have a mind of our own.
Yes.
And bringing up questions puts you in isolation to the sides. So in reality, and again, this whole idea of a fundamentalist mind that if you don't believe the state, so, and also then we vote for things that put people in marginal communities in more dangers, like criminalizing cigarette sales and things like that. You know, like Eric Garner in New York, and because we want to say we're anti-capitalist, but yet we're giving a capitalist government more tools to really govern us.
Yeah, and I think I would also add, like, look, even again, I'm in August. I'm for going on strike so we can spread the strike. That's what needs to happen. And the only reason we need to go on strike is ultimately to take the system down. There's no other reason. It's not fully funded public education I'm fighting for. Public education, as it was, is the same system that it is trying to be made it out to be, only they're accelerating it towards. What they're trying to do, this dystopian future they have for students, is one that was already been, I've already been working in that system. That's a capitalist system of education, which is about control, which is about workers being told what to do, prepared for exploitation. That is what public education is about. It's preparing workers for future exploitation. That system is about to be escalated by what is in mind with hybrid learning, with contact tracing, with the data collection that's going to go on with our students, with the data collection that's going to go on with me as they try to automate my job and create artificial intelligence which can do my job. That's the ultimate thing, right? But that, so capitalism hasn't changed. It's just accelerating that process. So the problem for me is with people saying, well, I'm not going to go back to school unless I'm healthy or I want 6 feet of separation. First of all, I'm basically saying that it's okay that all these students are having their data collected on them. It's not. It's not okay. Contact tracing on them is not okay. We have immigrant, like Alison McDowell talked about it. What do you do with kids who don't have social security numbers? What do you do with families that are here so-called illegally, you know? Contact tracing is basically the next step to being deported if we accept that. And we can't. We can't allow the state to have that kind of authority, not just over our immigrant sisters and brothers, but over us. Contact tracing, as it's being used in India, as it's being used in China, has not just been contact tracing. It's been used as social control, and it will be used that way in this country. So we can't accept it. But more than that is, am I going to say, if is it really solidarity with our families to say, well, I'm not going back to school until I'm healthy and your kid is healthy, when these people do have to work? And like, they have to get back to work. Now, I'm saying, look, we shouldn't get back to work. We should shut the system down. But I don't, like, to me, I don't feel like there's really solidarity with fellow workers to basically say, I'm not going back to school until you make sure that I'm safe and your kid is safe, when we know that the kid is not safe under these conditions, that there's going to be, it's a worse school experience, that our most vulnerable populations are going to be even more excluded. This is not a safe situation. It's a very unsafe situation we're going back to. And it was an unsafe situation before. And this is why I'm not for striking for fully funded education, which or for like smaller class sizes. No, it won't work. It doesn't work anymore. I've already said public education doesn't work as it is because it's under capitalism. We have to, the only fight that makes any sense right now is the fight to take the whole system on. And the only way I know of talking about that is by saying a strike to spread the strike. Because that to me seems like the next step.
I wanted to go back to a point that you had made in your email to your group, your organizing group, Strike Ready San Francisco. If I may, that's if we can go there.
Yeah.
Did you have something else along what Andy was saying, or should we?
Yes. I mean, my question was about how. What are the challenges of this small scope? It seems, you know, for example, teachers, because what you're talking about going to war with the capitalists, right? But what seems to be the focus on people is to ameliorate the conditions, to make them slightly better. And that's what I consider reformism, right? Like, just make it better, bearable, make capitalism more friendly, basically. So what are some of those challenges that, you know, make it hard for people to have that vision or to fight for that? And do people even understand this, like the people that you interact with? I don't know if that's okay to ask right now, but...
Well, you're going to have to keep me honest here and make sure I actually answer the question. So, first off, the reforms people are asking for are literally just, are not even reforms to advance. They're just to be like less punishment. I mean, that's most of the reforms, like keep our contracts, keep our pensions, maybe some smaller class sizes, you know, maybe a raise here. But what's being, even that is, our unions aren't asking for it. And the left, I guess, would say, we won't accept any austerity and we will be asking for some advances. That is very small, but even that people feel like we are not going to be able to really get that. So the next notion of reforms you can have is like what my fellow socialist Jack would be proposing, which is, look, why go for small things? Let's just say we want more schools. We want smaller classes. We want the schools to be even shut down for a year as we do this, you know, or possibly shut down for a year as we do this. And we want fully funded education. That's how I look at it. And I'm like, I don't want that. Like, I don't want, the reason I don't want that is because that doesn't work. Fully funded education under capitalism is an attack on workers. It is, because capitalism is an attack on workers. So for me, the problem I run into is anything I say that says, oh, I want this reform or I want that reform, is me lying to you. Is me saying, well, I think this reform is going to get it done. There is no reform that's going to get it done. We have to fight for taking the system down and replacing it with workers' control. And I don't see a way of doing that other than workers. The first act workers will have to do to take control is to stop the work they're doing, but do it on their terms. Right now what's happened is we've all been locked down. We've all been locked out of our workplace. But what workers have to do is basically go back in and gain control of their workplaces and then shut them down collectively and then reopen them as we see fit. And that's the process we have to go through. For me, the problem with talking about reforms, whether they're small or even reforms that are big, is none of them work because all of them keep the system intact. And that system is driving us towards World War III, is driving us to every 10 years, we have another economic crisis, which is worse than the last one. And every time that becomes the excuse to take everything away and you know, go after black people, go after immigrants, go after workers in other nations as well as within our own. And so I don't see a way of talking honestly about what we need to do other than say, well, we need to start fighting for revolution. And the way to do that is to start a strike that spreads a strike. And that's not what's going to happen with our union. But I don't know how to talk about, this honestly to people without saying that's what needs to happen. And that's my problem with talking about, just to talk, if you will, with reformism, or even to say, well, what are some reforms that you would fight for? I was like, I wouldn't fight for any reforms. We need to take the system down because none of these reforms will work. And then some socialists will say, well, what if we could come up with impossible reforms? I'm like, well, why even talk about them? Why not just talk about the impossible revolution instead of the impossible reforms? Who are we trying to fool here? I just want to be honest. And that's what has led me to kind of say this in this way. I actually think it's kind of absurd what I'm saying. Start a strike, because Strike Ready SF is not even in a position to strike. I know that I don't have a bunch of, I know we're not going to have a strike this year at my workplace. I mean, in UESF, the teachers voted 3,000 to 130 out of 6,000 members to extend our contract 2 years so we could avoid the notion of a strike. So I know workers aren't looking for a fight, but I don't know of any way of talking about what needs to happen other than the immediate need to fight and fight the capitalists. Anything else is just going to be an attack on us. I don't know. That's a long explanation, Kenny, but does that get at some of it?
Yeah. I mean, what I hear is that it's that just have to keep driving the message and hopefully sticks. And it's hard to know the specific context or the fertile ground that will make this fire spread. But right. Obviously, it is possible because we've seen things are contagious. Obviously, this the uprising, even though it doesn't have this framework, people when they see something, they might. They see something that works, maybe, like even if, like, just in this city, teachers actually strike and other workers strike because, you know, we had it with this and we take control of our own community, our own process of feeding, housing ourselves. Even something as simple as, you know, the rent. Say we all say, fuck it, we're not going to pay rent and no more banks here. Right. Done. Come and get us. But then right. We're going to have to defend ourselves because they're going to come and impose their will on us.
Right. And this gets me asked a question earlier before we started. This was who's my audience for this message, you know, like for what I'm writing here. And the audience are really anybody who is either a revolutionary, who they think of themselves as a revolutionary, or they're not a revolutionary, but they are sick and tired of I would put it this way, that they feel that the fight for revolution is an immediate task. That it starts now. It's not something that we do later when we're ready. We start that task now. And that's how I feel about this right now. And it, it's not that capitalism has changed. It's that I've changed. I used to be a socialist who was more for like, how do I create breadcrumbs for the workers so I can lead them to revolution? And I'm done with that, you know. And I'm not trying to figure out whether it's small breadcrumbs or how do I bake a whole big cake that really looks good. That's like reforms that are not possible to lead, and that you will make a revolution if you fight for those reforms. I'm done with that. At this point, I'm just a revolutionary who says we need a revolution. It has to happen now, and I need to find other revolutionaries who think the same way. And if you do think the same way, let's talk. And I don't know any other way of finding those people other than saying that I think of this socialist revolution as an immediate task, even though I know workers are not interested in making the kind of revolution that we need to make. Out of notion of safety, out of notion of like, you know, oh, it's dangerous, or out of a notion of, you know, we have to keep ourselves safe from a coronavirus. The coronavirus is the least of our problems. We have a capitalist class that's killing us and is preparing to kill us on large scale and use us on large scale to grind us into World War III. So that, to me, is what we're facing.
Do you have, in history, a time that you can say that revolution happens immediately? Or did it happen progressively?
No, I mean, I think it did happen quickly. I mean, I do think, like, the Russian Revolution, the Paris Commune, those were fairly quick. The period of the formation of the workers' councils in the were, like, months. It was almost a year, basically, over which that happened. Now, there was a party that was built in a 10 to 20-year period prior to that. That party does not exist here. But no, I do believe if the revolution is going to happen, it's going to have to happen relatively quickly. Like, you know, but I think that I'm in the process in the very beginning of trying to figure out how do I find other people who are thinking that even though that we are far away from organizationally and ideologically as a class to be prepared for a revolution, how do we grow ourselves and talk about the task as an immediate one? Because I do think I do think revolution is an immediate task for the working class, even if workers aren't ready for it. And revolutionaries have been reluctant to speak of it that way. And I think we need to start talking that way.
I would add to that, because I hear in my circles that this whole notion of harm reduction that I keep bringing up, there is no in the meantime for me. And even when you look at the evidence of particular issues, they're getting worse. And the fight back is getting weaker and weaker. So there is no in the meantime. That actually is a euphemism for let's just resist here. Let's just not let them push us even further. When we have to be swinging back and pushing back, and with the goal to win, otherwise we'll always fall short. But yeah, I mean, I really don't see an issue where we are making progress.
And this is for me. This is a guess. Like I said, I was trained to operate as a socialist in a sort of this iterative way, a sort of like. Show the working class the first door, the next door, open that up, and then they see the next door, then they see the next door. That's how I was trained. It's like called like transition program, a notion of putting forward slogans that are reforms that lead people in the direction of revolution. I'm done with that. And I don't think it doesn't make any sense for me to talk about what we need to do unless I'm talking about how do we make that revolution now. Even though there's not enough of us to even begin to make that happen, but how do you get more of us? I feel like I have to say the things that revolutionaries need to say and not be afraid to say them, and see if there's other people who are willing to say them with me. Because if you're not, then you're not going to want to be a socialist with me. You're going to want to be a socialist with somebody else who is like, kind of like, well, I don't really agree that Bernie Sanders is going to make a change, but I'm going to tell people that. Because they're going to realize through doing this that Bernie Sanders was a lie, and then they're going to start more coming to revolution. It's like, why are we playing games with head games with people? Why don't we just tell people what we stand for? Why don't we just tell people Bernie Sanders is a fraud? He's not going to get you anything. Democratic Party is a fraud. They're not going to get you anything. We need to have a revolution. That's it. I mean, the working class needs to be independent, and the working class cannot accept even – we're not even fighting for a labor party. We're fighting for insurrection, armed insurrection. That's not what a labor party wants. It's like – and we're going to need – we will need to be able to build a – I do believe a revolutionary organization will need to be built that's capable of making an argument like that to fellow workers. And that argument is not just being made to people who are at George Floyd demonstrations. I would say revolutionaries have a responsibility to go to those demonstrations where people were armed at in front of those state buildings and tell those workers, you have the right to be armed. You have the right to be pissed off about being put in shelter in place and being told to quarantine and your business shutting down. But guess what? Guess who your ally is? Your ally are black workers. Your ally are gay workers. Your ally are immigrants coming across the border. They're not, Republicans or not whoever, you know. Your ally are those people. So I believe revolutionaries need to be comfortable talking to both of those groups. And we're not going to be in neither group will people agree with us. But we're going to be there because I agree with that the quarantine has to be fought, and I agree that the murder of George Floyd needs to be fought. Racism needs to be fought. And those two things ultimately what are going to have to be brought together. Revolutionaries are the only one who I believe should be are in a position to draw those two struggles together.
Did you want to follow up, Kenny? I have more questions.
I agree in the sense that we will have to listen to that, you know, the right, and that's where we fail on the left, that we through our elitist condescending approach that dumb, they're ignorant, they're backwards, that they don't know what they're doing because they're not listening to their stakes. And we're not reading into what's really happening behind. We are immediate to dismiss them. But yes, I would go and I would be, listen, I get it. Fuck those liberal talking heads. You know, they're having post-capitalism and they fucked you over, you know, with NAFTA and all these things. Because and your enemy is not the Mexican worker. You know, your enemy is those fuckers that keep selling you lies. And guess what? Like, even when you even Fox News, they know this language. They actually have radical language that they use because people are fed up with government. They actually have more of the language that we do, I feel. The right wing, they weaponize that against the left, which is hilarious. You know, we on the left don't even have that language in our public debates.
Because by and large, the left, which is largely captured under the Democratic Party, hates workers. It's contemptuous of workers. They think workers are stupid, and they think workers don't know any better. They think that those people who are rioters or looters don't even know what they're fucking doing. They don't understand. It's like, no, they actually do get a lot. I don't know. I have to talk to them, but I think they get something about what's going on. Do I think that's going to work? It did work to get the attention of the capitalist class. I definitely know that, but it's not going to get them what they want. They're going to have to be organized under the banner of the working class fighting for socialist revolution if they actually get what they want. The people who are armed, demanding that their states, that the quarantine be lifted, have a lot more in common with people who are burning down Target than they recognize. Those people have a lot in common, actually. And to the extent that they don't understand that is to the extent to which the capitalists are going to take advantage of both groups. And the only people who can draw that commonality out are socialists. But we can't do that by telling right-wing workers, by not bringing up the issue of immigration or racism. We will have to challenge it to the extent that it exists in that group. Similarly, we can't go to these Black Lives Matter and defund whatever, the police stuff, and say, oh yeah, the Democrats are going to get you what you want, and defund the police is going to get you there. It ain't going to get you there. This is a trick. They're trying to drive you back into the Democratic Party, and defund the police is a lie. Because they have every intention of building a stronger police force to control you, and they have to because wealth is going from you upwards. And there's no way the police force can be getting weaker when the divide between rich and poor is getting stronger. It can't happen. No state can survive that way. They need a stronger police force in order to keep those things in place. So defund the police is a lie, because both these parties oversaw the transfer of wealth upward, not just through the stimulus bill, but through the quarantine itself, which enriched the wealthiest in this country. The largest capitalists got richer. That was overseen by our capitalist class, bipartisan. So do you think those people are planning on building a weaker police force? Absolutely not.
I would, again, just that one last point. And the small capitalists are here with us, you know, eating shit, basically. Because they have more in common with us than they will ever have with Bezos.
They should. Sometimes they go straight to the right wing. And we'll have to see. They should come to our side. I do believe they only come to the workers' side if the working class is strong and organized enough to draw that middle class towards them and to say, oh, yeah, we'll win with them. Otherwise, they will kind of be like, oh, I'm just for myself, you know. But I will say they are going to find they're themselves eating shit as well.
That's what I mean. We're eating shit together.
Yeah.
Right. So you wrote in your email, if I may read, this is to Strike Ready San Francisco. I will continue to work in Strike Ready San Francisco where I agree, such as fighting the cuts and building for a strike.
Yeah.
But I won't work with SRSF to support any distance learning in August. Distance learning and contact tracing are tools of our enemy to further enslave us.
Yes.
They must be opposed, like education cuts and police brutality and arresting or deporting immigrants.
Yeah.
So I had asked you prior to this, we were on the phone, and I said one of my questions to you would be, how do you intend to go back to work or how do you see school and the role of technology? Because it almost seems as if you don't want any tech to have a role in education. Again, what people are worried about is that it is, again, about COVID-19. And they find that having a hybrid, and even your group, I was reading what they had said, their statement, which they said they would accept some form technology in education, would be simply as a learning tool. But you're saying not even as a learning tool, because it's an online, you said here, distance learning will only aid the enemy. I'm using aid to further enslave us.
Yeah. I mean, first off, I'm going to go and try to answer about technology and distance learning. Strike Ready SF supports or accepts the possibility of distance learning and says, we accept that we might have to do a hybrid model or something like that.
Right.
That is a no-go for me. That is literally just asking our schools to become privatized. And it's going down the road of student data collection, all the things I just brought up. And it makes...
Allison
brought up. And public education being just a miserable experience of... It's just going to be awful in the schools if we abide by this whole thing. So that's the first thing. But the other question of technology is... I will say my mind has been awakened to the true role of technology in education. I've even said in the past, well, I can see it. We can use technology to help students, you know, like do other things that they couldn't otherwise do. And what is it called? As a supplement, right? And the reality is we as the workers aren't in control of our use of technology. The capitalists are. So I will say this. I will say I'm opposed to distance learning because it's a mechanism for dismantling public education as it exists, which does need to be dismantled because we have to take capitalism down. But I'm not going to agree to make it obviously worse, you know. But secondly, I have become aware that really all technology is being used against workers under capitalism. Ultimately, it's a tool against us. Now, if we put it into our own hands and try to use it as a weapon to fight the capitalists, maybe we can use Facebook, or maybe we can use the internet. Maybe we can use computers to communicate with one another so we can organize our strikes. Yes, you know, they're obviously going to be trying to get in there to shut that down now, right? That's partly what's going on with not just their surveillance stuff and the data collection, but they are really trying to control people by knowing who you're around and who you're communicating with. And that was happening even before with Edward Snowden and the NSC. So I think I've become aware in a way that I probably should have been aware, but I feel like I've changed here, is to really come to an understanding that all technology is ultimately, as long as capitalism is still in place, all technology is going to be used as a weapon against me and my fellow workers. And so, you know, yeah, I'm going to use a computer to communicate with a student, or I'm going to give them a program, or introduce them to a program that might teach them something. But I should have no illusions that that's really what this technology is about. Ultimately, this technology is being introduced as a mechanism for my immiseration and to create even greater shackles on us as workers, and to make our life even more alienated and miserable, so that capitalists can rule over us.
Yeah, so, I can maybe give some practical examples in the restaurant industry. For example, tablets. Now, a lot of companies are providing tablets for servers. And now, you know, they can basically track how active they are on their iPads, you know, whether they're wasting time or not. They also don't have to walk to a station. So it's about extraction and of more work for the same or less money. And so it's about profit creation. It's also about profit extraction or value extraction from us as consumers. So anywhere you live, I agree with you that technology is really shackles. It's not to enhance our lives, even though they sell it that way. But in reality, we live more stressed lives. You know, you, Eduardo, I think you would agree on that. We are constantly bombarded with things, and we don't even know up from down anymore. You know, and so we are just, and now they want to make it an essential part of education. And again, it's under capitalist control, and there's the driving force there is profit. It's not the education is not making people better humans. It's to, again, train better workers or sort them out at the end of the day, yeah, to see, yeah, who will be exploited more in what way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's everywhere. And so it is not about enhancing life again or prioritizing life. It's always being driven by the profit motive.
And we will find out which technologies could be used for class struggle and taking the capitalists down when we actually engage in that class struggle. Until then, I'm not going to speculate about which technologies will be used. We have to start the fight first. Then we're going to find out which technologies can actually be turned into something we can use for ourselves for that. I'm not going to speculate beforehand. But until we do that, it's all being used as a weapon against us.
I mean, even people that are working from home, I know a friend who, whatever, she says that they track whether your mouse is moving or not. You know, little things like that.
Right. Now, Facebook, Twitter, and I forget what other company are permanently going to let their workers work from home.
Right.
Remotely. And yeah, they are tracking. They're updating or creating new software to try to track people's
right.
work.
There's an interesting quote that I can't remember where I heard it, but it's Rosa Luxemburg. That somebody was quote, it was Glenn Greenwald. And Glenn Greenwald said that Rosa Luxemburg said this. He said, workers who don't move don't see their chains, don't hear their chains. If you don't move, you never know the chains you have on you, all right? And I do think technology is like chains. Now, you can sometimes take your chains off and you can strangle your prisoner, right? So the person who's holding you prison. We won't know which of all these chains that we currently have on us can be turned into weapons to go against our oppressor until we wage that fight. And that's how I look at this. So all this technology is a chain. All these tools we've made, they are made by the capitalists to chain us and to make us more easily controlled and more productive and more able to be exploited. Which of these technologies will be beneficial to us in class struggle, we won't know until we engage in.
And obviously we have a generations or more generations of kids that don't know a world without those chains of technology. And hopefully they'll be able to turn them, like you said, back on their on the masters of these worlds.
But, and I would just say that those chains have been there for generations, even before the internet or whatever. And they've always, there's always been new things developed. The what is it? The Gutenberg and the printing press, you know? So there's always new things that are developed, but, and those are always tools that are used by primarily by the capitalists against us. But the situation of what can be utilized to make our world a place that we can live in struggle, we'll find out when we do it.
Let's get to Jack's question about contact tracing, which was one of four of the points that you had made earlier in the beginning of this episode, which is, do you personally think that there is a security issue with contact tracing? I mean, I think we've touched on this, but just to get to Jack's question, you speak specifically to contact tracing.
I mean,
you know, because it is touted as something that can be effective to combat to combat COVID-19.
Yeah, I mean, I recognize all these states are talking about how they're using it, but I guess I'll just, what was it? I think it was Forbes, I think, that was talking about the way they were looking at China. I mean, hold on, I got to find something. They were talking about the, checking phone data to see if people have come within close range of coronavirus patient, temperature checks, facial recognition software, making people download software that uses data from our accounts to estimate their health and give them color-coded risk contagion and share it with law enforcement. So this was The Atlantic basically saying, look what China is doing, monitoring people with drones. This is all this contact tracing. And The Atlantic is laying out the Chinese plan for contact tracing and saying, look how authoritarian and controlling this government is. Well, this is what's coming our way. And whatever is going to be authoritarian for China is going to be authoritarian for us. And Google and Apple are certainly no more trustworthy than Huawei or whatever company that's running those things in China. All of them are ultimately about collecting our data and knowing who you talk with, when you talked with them, where you were, and then just, why would we want the state to have that information about us? That to me seems like a very bad idea. But not the state that is, that people are understanding, murders black people, you know, and doesn't care about workers. Doesn't care about immigrant workers, doesn't care about black workers, doesn't care about workers in general. Why would we want the state to have that? And they can say, oh, well, you know, it's going to be encrypted. And it's not. I mean, it will be, but all this stuff is going to be accessible to the U.S. government. And the Apple and Google programs, the API programs that they're proposing, are only going to be used by government bureaucracies in health. And those are no more trustworthy than, than the NSC, frankly.
So,
is that worth saying?
Yeah, I think so. It's part of reopening up schools, Andy.
Yeah, okay.
This is, contact tracing is something that you shared with us, if I may, here. You shared with us two links in an email from edweek.org, and you shared with us from the AFT organization. But I'll speak to some of the stuff that you had said about the role of technology, if I may. And that is that I do understand when you say that this is a political trap, because in the language here, it's very persuasive to have educators and families embrace technology. It says here, we must expand the access to broadband and technology to close the digital divide. Districts should identify students and educators who lack sufficient access to the internet and hardware that has become critical to distance learning, and determine solutions for equal, these are key words, equal access to learning opportunities for those who are unable to connect with the school digitally.
And that's the union language, right?
That's AFT.
Yeah.
And the role of data, beyond refocusing schools on the fundamental values of public schooling, a focus that has been lost over the years, it is also time to repurpose the role of information and data in our schools. For too long, officials have used school and student data solely for accountability purposes. As we reopen our schools, we need to primarily use this data to guide instruction, identify and share best practices, and help collectively solve mutual problems. But that isn't necessarily what that data will be used ultimately. It's not even disguised here. It just won't tell you that that data, as Alison McDowell, who has extensive research, and we will link her episode in the episode notes, has demonstrated through her presentations, people really should check her out, that that data isn't for this, for these practices. It's really ultimately for a higher surveillance cost.
And to develop, with the idea of technology and the internet being the fourth industrial revolution, the developing of AI, of artificial intelligence. I mean, this is explicitly put out in the national security strategy about data collection as needed to build and to essentially build the most effective artificial intelligence programs in any field. Whether it be in the military, whether it be in the economically, whatever thing you need for health, what was it? This came out from an NSC document that was not the same as the strategy, but this was an NSC document in 2019. It said the development of AI will shape the future of power. The nation with the most resilient and productive economic base will be best positioned to seize the mantle of world leadership. That base increasingly depends on the strength of the innovation economy, which in turn will depend on AI. AI will drive waves of advancement in commerce, transportation, health, education, financial markets, government, and national defense. And Vladimir Putin put it later, artificial intelligence is the future, not only for Russia, but for all humankind. It comes with colossal opportunities, but also threats that are difficult to predict. Whoever becomes the leader in this sphere will become ruler of the world. And the thing that the U.S. is desperately afraid of is that while the U.S. has been the prominent creator of AI technologies, China is well ahead of them in collecting data on its populations, on collecting data in the markets in Africa and in Europe. And the U.S. is trying to play catch-up. You need to collect that data so you can process it and refine it and build better AI. That's what AI lives off of. It's the oil for AI. And so that is what we are. When we go to a distance learning program, when we go to contact tracing, we are feeding that animal. We are feeding that data into the capitalist system, and we are literally giving ourselves over to this battle. That's going to essentially mean distance learning ultimately means you're getting rid of physical buildings for schools. You're getting rid of teachers and turning them into like automated, you know, experiences. And you're turning students into isolated data widgets that you can more easily control, and they don't get together. They don't get together because they're worried about a virus, but they no longer have a collective experience in a school. Now, what would schools look like under socialism? One thing I will say is they are social experiences. They require community in order to do it. They're not going to be the same thing as this public education mess we have. And if they are, then the revolution failed. Okay, but I will say that they have the real education has nothing to do with an atomized person on a computer screen learning from another computer or learning from a human remotely. You have to get involved with other people. You have to be in community with other people. That's part of education because we are social creatures. This is something we literally said in our Strike Ready SF document, and unfortunately, people are think we said it just as like a as a throwaway. It's not a throwaway. It's essential to the education experience. Now, can we arrive at that under capitalism? We cannot. We can do social-like things, but unfortunately, that social-like thing is being used to exploit us and is being used to create an education system which isn't a friend of workers. And that's what public education currently is. So we can't go forward into distance learning, and we can't go backward into public education as it was. So the only way is to revolution.
And this cause for AI is cause for the role of tech in data collection is further promoted through the guise of closing the digital gap or the digital divide. I was speaking to the family specialist of my nephew, and we're the only ones in this past school year where we were trying to keep him off tech in the classroom. And everyone else, all of the other families, sort of didn't have a position. They were just, you know, letting the wave carry them. And when I spoke to the family specialist, she's in the last conference call we had, she said that the conversations, because I said, what about families like ours that really don't want tech to have a role in our child's life in school, their education? It's like the conversations that really having, those aren't the conversations that are being had professional development meetings or workshops or meetings with principals and in the larger framework of education. People are really, really talking about closing the gap, digital divide, that exists in working class communities where there isn't access to the internet. So,
and the fact is that you could get a Chromebook in everyone's hand, you could put great Wi-Fi in everyone's, and you start the digital, the quote, divide is going to grow. I'm not going to just call it a digital divide. The educational experience is going, the divide about an educational experience that actually seems like you're getting anything out of it is going to grow and grow and grow as we go down this road. I don't care if you gave everyone a Chromebook. I don't care if everyone's got a great Wi-Fi. The fact is a lot of these students don't have a background that allows them to know the things that would allow them to even engage in some of this kind of stuff. And language is such an issue. So yeah. One of the things that they're not talking about in our school, or at least in our school district, is already as we prepare for a distance learning thing, we've already been told that our EL numbers are going to be way down next year. Why is that? Did those students just all run out of the San Francisco? Like, they're leaving education. Now, I actually think it's also part of the economy. They have to go to work. But the educational experience they just had over the last month or 2 months was awful. And the only thing it did is convince them they don't want to go back. And so the digital, to the extent that the digital divide is going to be done like this, it's going to be because we're going to be shifting, we're going to be filtering people out who can't even play the game. And we're going to only be talking about people who can be in the game of doing this through some sort of remote technological online way. And there's going to be a divide there even. But what we're really doing is just literally removing people from the books and then call it, and saying the digital divide is getting narrower.
And what's in there is the psychological aspect, which we haven't discussed much here.
Yes.
We're mostly focused, but maybe we'll talk about bringing on some people that can talk about how, just in general as well, as a human, it is just very unnatural for us to,
yeah.
It's the screen new deal that is being
yes.
offered to us.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder where do y'all think we should take it at this point?
I think there is one more question that wasn't Jack's or Brian's. It was my question. And my question was formed this way, but I'm going to ask in a different way or expand to it. I asked here in the document, I said, would you not think that forming a caucus within your union or some form of faction would be more effective for to promote the idea of a strike? And I guess that's also, I'll supplement, I'll expand it with your strategy. You say that it's about calling for a strike, to expand for larger strikes and for other solidarity strikes. Strategically, would it not make sense to create a faction? You were part of a caucus before.
Yeah.
Would it not make sense to create another faction to work with other folks, other like-minded individuals within your union?
I will say that if Strike Ready SF is prepared to push for a strike in August, even under issues that are not like the issue that they could say we're not going back to work because we're concerned about health. I'll support the strike, but I won't support the reasons. I'll put it that way. It's because I think that honestly, I think that's the wrong reason to strike. But I actually think that's what workers need to do, is we need to withhold our labor and fight and basically take control of this system and say, you're not going to push us around. So that's kind of the way I'd put that. So if Strike Ready SF is prepared to push for a strike in relationship to the austerity that's being pushed on us, or even to push for, so that one I fully agree, but even with the one around health, so because it's not a healthy situation under which we're doing, I'll be in that strike and I'll just say, this is not my reasons for striking. My reasons for striking are because I want to oppose distance learning, I want to oppose contact tracing, and I want to spread the strike. And there are no conditions the capitalists could give us that would make me not want to strike and stop our strike. We need to spread it. That's my reason for striking, but I'll join in the strike because I think the action of withholding our work and taking control of that is the most important thing we could do. So that's number one. Do I think Strike Ready's SF is going to do that? I don't think so. But if it tries to do that, then I'll figure out a way of working with people who want to strike. Yes. But the biggest thing I'm really looking for are the revolutionaries, whether they be educators or not. We're trying to figure out, how do we talk about revolution as an immediate task? Because it needs to happen. It needs to start now. And how do we do that effectively without talking about things as if there's reforms that will lead us there? And there are no reforms that get us to revolution. There's only actions of workers and workers changing themselves through those actions that are going to make that happen. Now, workers will strike for reforms, and I will join them in those strikes, but I'm not striking for the reforms. I'm striking for a different reason. I'm going on strike to spread that strike. So there's no end that I see for that strike short of insurrection that makes any sense. So I guess that's what I put it, is I will join with any group of fellow educators in San Francisco who are prepared to strike. And if they're from Strike Ready SF, I'm definitely going to work with them. But I'm also looking to find other fellow radicals or socialists who see this task as an immediate one, who sees revolution as an immediate task, not as something that's in the distance that will get there eventually, and are prepared to talk about it that way.
The uprisings that exist right now would be it's an energy that should be tapped into. They're looking for a direction, I feel, except I do really think that there is something there that they could go from here. They have a momentum, but the Democrats, they're really good at sneaking their way in and co-opting the movement and using, I hate saying this, using some of the, like, George Floyd's family members for their cause, speak on behalf of them.
Yeah.
But that's a very sensitive thing to say, so I have to be careful.
They are using, because the Democrats are responsible for his death. They're responsible for creating the three strikes kind of crap and the they are.
Don't say that, Andy. You can create division.
They are. I'm not.
You say whatever
that.
You want, but I do feel it's a little, you know, it's a very sensitive topic because we're talking about a plight that is happening to the Black community, and it can be misinterpreted or mischaracterized what we're saying here. But I know we're not, we're, the three of us are looking for a greater cause for this movement. It's just that sometimes in people's listening to in their trauma or whatever, and being whispered by the Democrats to go and pursue a different way could make them.
I'm not exaggerating, though. I want to be clear. Joe Biden and the Democratic Party are responsible for the expanding of police on the streets, for the expanding of the prison population,
yes.
For
yes,
targeting
you.
Blacks with three strikes, targeting poor people with three strikes laws that criminalize them. So they helped fund these police departments and give them the weapons. So I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah.
Joe Biden is responsible
for
the death.
You didn't say that earlier. In that framing, yes, that is what I would rather you supplement your earlier response with.
Okay.
And that is what you mean when
but,
you say
but
the Democrats
clear,
are responsible for
the
this death because of the expansion of the military police reforms
yes,
that exist.
Yes,
I understand.
And
yeah.
And that includes Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez and all the people who call themselves Democratic Party members who support that apparatus. So they're all their hands have blood on, in my mind. Because they're all looking to get that criminal Biden elected. And they are all propping up this capitalist party.
The form that whatever is taking place right now, shape is taken. It's not. I'm not very optimistic because they robbed us all in plain, in broad daylight, and we're not even talking about capitalism. It's not even part of the conversation. We are here. In our community in San Francisco, some of my groups debating whether we should talk about whether we should have something to say about this moment. That's the extent of the debate, So whether it's sensitive or it's not sensitive, whether we fundraise now or we don't fundraise, it's not about uniting the fights. It's about just stepping on eggshells. And so in that way, we are way behind than even the failed Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
We're worried about that, and that was massive too. And it also died at the hand of Obama. And so I'm not very optimistic at all about this moment. And we have a lot of work to do. And I agree with Lipson. That is my approach. That I've come to my own conclusion is that I have to be open about it. This is what I believe. People will listen. Some people are reaching out. At least in my groups, some people want to talk about, but. I have to be ready to talk about things that people don't want to hear. And some will stick around. And hopefully there's enough people that want to see past the bullshit and let go. And because that's what it takes. You have to let go of these illusions that with little reforms, we are doing damage control. We are not at all.
Right. And that's a really important point. I mean, people have stuck around to this. People in Strike Ready SF, I put this thing out. It did not go over well. It wasn't like people disagreed with it. It was just ignored. Like, it was like people didn't say anything about it. It was just like, maybe that'll go away. And I mean, I wrote it. It is what it is. We got, our union has just got played around its contract. And myself and two other people have said, we have to completely retool and we have to push for a strike and start a strike process. And even that now is being ignored. So, I want to be clear, what I've put out has not been a rallying cry to finding other radicals. I'll be honest, it hasn't, but it is what I believe. And the one thing I don't want to do anymore is I don't want to make up what I stand for. I don't want to say that I stand for something else other than this, because this is really what I believe we need to do. Are we ready to do it? No, but this is what I believe we need to do. And this is the only thing that would lead to a path that would lead to true safety and health for our students, for our workers, is to engage in class struggle and get into that battle as quickly as possible, because they are taking us over a cliff that the capitalists are not in control of. And we're not talking about hundreds of thousands dead. We're talking millions, billions when we talk about World War III. And this is what's in stake here. And particularly when they talk about putting that in the hands of artificial intelligence side by side with humans. This is what they have in mind for war. It's like, this is very, very dangerous. And this is the future. The only way we avoid that future is starting that fight now. We can't wait. So, I hope this was helpful.
It was, and I think mostly you, because mostly you were the one who was speaking, delved into other areas about reform, revolution, very consistent themes of of what's left.
So thank you both for doing this. We'll see what it leads to. This will get out there as well. We've got some interesting episodes coming up in the future with talk about the Big Bang and stuff like this. But I definitely appreciate both of you giving me the chance to think some of this stuff through and try to come up with what I really believe about this stuff and pressing me on it. So I appreciate that.
And you should share Alison McDowell's McDowell, no?
Yeah.
Alison McDowell's episode.
Yeah, definitely. That's going to be on here. I think the thing on public education will be on here because that was in the back of my mind because I don't think we can go back to public education. Yeah. You know, it's like it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And there's a few other episodes. A stimulus package episode I think we'll put on here as well.
Which Steve Mnuchin is not wanting to reveal where that money, a lot of the bailout money, has gone to.
Mm-hmm.
And
some of our early coronavirus episodes where we questioned even early on the level of like, what the hell are they talking about? This is like a flu. And frankly, I think that shit's been borne out. People want to say, oh, it's not the flu. It's the fucking flu.
I want to talk to you about that one at the end. So let's conclude. Let's conclude before you speak more. All right. We're such a trio, honestly. let's conclude before. All right. All right. That does it for this week's episode. What's Left is a weekly political podcast / channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes wherever you found this episode or on our blog at what-s-left.webmail.com. You can find past episodes to this podcast / channel there and connect with us. And I remind folks that if you like anything that you have heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe to any of our 6 platforms. Again, thank you, Andy, for that. On iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Barco with co-hosts Kenny Cepeda and Andy Lipson. See you all next time. Ciao.
All right. Take care.